Good evening. I'd like to call the March 1st, 2001 meeting of the legislature to order. The first item on our agenda is a public hearing on the CDBG right to discuss general housing, public facilities, and economic development needs in the county related to our community development block grant. Leslie Schill, welcome.
Hi, good evening, everyone. I'm Leslie Schill with the County Planning Department. I'm here this evening to offer an opportunity for the community to bring proposals to consider to apply to the Community Development Block Grant Funds. We have applied to these funds before for our homeownership program on a semi-annual basis, usually every other year, so this is an off year, and we thought this might be an opportunity for other housing needs in the community to be met. And so we wanted to put this out here as something that the county might consider applying for and serving as the conduit for. So this will be the first of two public hearings. There will be a follow-up public hearing on April the 20th should there be a proposal that is determined to go forward if this is put forth. So at this point, I just want to open it up, and if anyone has any comments or questions, I can be reached at the County Planning Department. Again, my name is Leslie Schill.
Thank you, Leslie. Would anyone else like to be heard on this topic? So these blue are for public privilege? Okay.
Good evening. I'm Stacey Murphy. I am the Energy Services Director at Tompkins Community Action. We do a number of housing residential energy efficiency programs at the county, for the county. The biggest one is the Weatherization Assistance Program, which is federally funded, and also some NYSERDA residential energy efficiency programs, primarily for people who have limited income. We would like to promote the idea of a housing rehabilitation application to CDBG this year that would focus primarily, but not entirely, on replacing poor roofing conditions, because that's a need we see quite frequently and quite prevalently. In our weatherization program, we go out and we do energy audits, but then very often we find that we are not able to move forward with weatherizing a home because of leaking roof conditions. Right now we have 20 applications on hold for issues that need to be corrected before we can weatherize, and I'd say about 60% of those are leaking roofs. We've been talking to other not-for-profits in town, other county agencies. The Office for the Aging has told us that in the past year, they had an emergency fund called Restore to help seniors with emergency repair needs, and of the 55 people they served, more than half of those had roofing needs also. I think there was somebody at the county planning department who studied it this summer. We've also talked to our partners at the housing groups at Better Housing and INHS, and it seems to be a big need for a lot of people. So we've been thinking about the possibility of an application that would target roof repairs. If we could secure housing rehab funds to help more people repair their roofs and other pressing housing needs, then we would be able to pair the CDBG funds with the weatherization program, because those folks could then go on and access residential energy efficiency through weatherization or through a NYSERDA program, probably. It would help meet several objectives. It would help address pressing health and safety needs, because when you have leaking roofs, you get a lot of indoor air quality issues that are caused by moisture and mold. This especially affects people with respiratory problems. It would help people who are financially strapped to then get their homes weatherized, so that way they would be more energy efficient. It would save on their heating bills. It would give TC Action a mechanism to continue to keep people employed in living wage green collar jobs, because we would do the roofing work prior to going in and doing the weatherization work. We have our own crews of people that work, and a number of them have roofing skills. And it would assist the county with meeting its goals around residential efficiency and carbon reduction. Now, there aren't just roofing needs in homes. There's a lot of other needs, and in talking to the people who run the CDBG program at the state, they would want to see that the other things are being addressed. Like, you can't just fix somebody's roofing needs and make their home more efficient and walk away if, like, their, you know, their foundation is crumbling or they have a well problem or something. So we've been exploring ways to provide a fuller complement of services to people by pairing the CDBG resource possibly with other groups that have other funding. like INHS and Better Housing, and we've been exploring those relationships, so a collaboration might be possible, too, through this. So that's what we would like you to consider. Thanks.
Thank you, Stacy. Would anyone else like to address the legislature?
My name is John Spence. I'm Executive Director of Better Housing for Tompkins County, and I will piggyback on what Stacy was just referring to. We actually approached it. We work with a grant writer, and we're associated with other rural preservations around the state. And one of the successful projects that other RPCs have been using has been addressing, using CDBG funding to address needs for well and septic repair and improvement. We talked with the local health department and asked if that would be a need that they would support, and could they help us get data, and if we were able to apply for this kind of funding, would that be of benefit to Tompkins County? They said absolutely. Obviously, septic issues are ones that if a septic system goes bad, the health department has to step in and shut that down, and leaves low-income families with a an expensive and insurmountable problem. So we've talked with Stacy. TCA and Better Housing have collaborated most recently on a home grant, housing rehab grant out in Dryden. We work on other grants, so we are comfortable and capable of working with these folks. We think that probably there's a way, if the county were to apply for the maximum amount of funding, that both our needs, and we fully support the idea of roofs, we see it all the time as well. So we're hoping that through some conversations we can work out the details and both of these important needs would be met. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Anyone else? This closes the public hearing. Would you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call of members. Mr. Burbank?
I'm here.
Ms. Chack?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Present.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa has asked to be excused. Mr. Stein?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
14 members present.
Proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I'd like to ask for an executive session at the end of this meeting to speak about a personnel issue. And when we get to the actual motions, I'm going to juggle the order of things because I see staff and guests in the audience. I want to accommodate some folks who don't necessarily want to stay through all of our business. So, hi, Jean. All right. Privilege of the floor for the public. We have a few people signed up. Your time limit is 3 minutes, and Kathy will help you with that. And if anybody else wants to speak at the end, just you can come up to the mic. First is Joe Wilson and then Neil Uli.
Good evening, everyone. I am Joe Wilson. My wife and I live in Ellis Hollow. We are retirees. We support the proposed resolution to extend the tax surcharge on wealthy New Yorkers. I thank you all for speaking out for the vast majority of us New Yorkers. As you have noted, in a day when there was something closer to shared sacrifice in the area of state income taxes, there was a top bracket of 15% for the wealthy. Now Governor Cuomo has said he wants to reduce the current top brackets to about half that. In doing so, he will give away $4 to $5 billion, which would greatly help to close the $9 to $10 billion budget shortfall that the state faces. He wants us to give this money back to the wealthy, despite the fact that a majority of voters, including those who just put him in office, favor keeping the current surcharge in place. I am sad to say that I have concluded that Governor Cuomo is simply pandering to his friends and big money supporters. There is no other logical explanation for why he would act contrary to the voters' wishes and in a such fiscally irresponsible way. In doing so, he has made the portrayal of him in the current TV ad disgustingly real. The actor playing Governor Cuomo and Governor Cuomo himself are both saying to the middle class, our children and our have-nots, someone has to sacrifice to keep my wealthy friends and supporters happy, and you're it. I look forward to the unanimous vote of approval for this resolution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Neil Uhlian and Bob Spaulding.
Good evening. My name is Neil Uhle. Those who know me know that I wear several different hats in that community. Today it's the Tompkins County Workers Center I'm representing. We feel that this resolution is very important. We feel that equity, that people should pay their fair share of taxes, is one of the most important things we can have, and it's one of the things that we're sorely lacking right now. Sometimes when I'm reading the news and looking at what's going on in our own state, I wonder, do I live in Wisconsin? Because that's what it seems like. The problem started in Wisconsin when the governor of Wisconsin gave big tax breaks to the wealthiest people and had no way to make it up except on the backs of the people of the state. And that's where we are today. Our governor wants to give a big tax break to the rich people. Poor people, the people that are working, are going to have to make up that difference, or they're going to lose services. And what's going to happen to the teachers and the other people that are members of our public employee unions and who work for our communities and keep us safe? What's going to happen to the people who salt the roads in the wintertime and the money for the salt? Where is that difference going to come from? It's not going to come from the rich if the governor has his way. I'm asking you to support the resolution supporting the extension of the tax surcharge on wealthy New Yorkers to help close the budget gap and to help try to keep some equity in the tax structure that we have now. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. Bob Spaulding.
Good evening. I'm Bob Spaulding. I live in Ellis Hollow, and I'm the treasurer of the Ithaca Board of Realtors this year. I'd like to speak just briefly in opposition to an increase in the MRT. I think this is exactly the wrong time to do that. The housing here in Tompkins County is okay, but it's sputtering. It's not really robust like it should be. Last year in 2010, the average house sale was $170,000. Transfer taxes that would be paid for somebody getting a mortgage on a house that costs $170,000 is somewhere around $2,500. That's a lot of money, and it affects the people who can afford it the least, the most, because it's very regressive in nature. It's regressive, I say, because people who can afford to pay cash for a house don't have to pay this tax. It's only the people that can't really afford it that have to pay it. We'd like you to consider, you know, opposing this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Would anyone else like to address the legislature? Thank you. I don't see any municipal officials out there. True? Okay. Legislator, privilege of the floor. Pat.
Thank you, Martha. I'd like to take just a couple minutes to let you all know that the Broadband Committee is continuing to meet, and we met again yesterday. We've had some very lively discussion at each one of our meetings, and the thoughtfulness and the level of participation by the members of the committee is just outstanding. I can't say enough good things about all of the people that have volunteered and are participating on this committee. It just really makes me feel good to see that there's this level of commitment by people to bringing broadband to everybody in Tompkins County. In many cases, and probably all cases, I think, maybe not, maybe there's one or two, but for the most part, people on the committee already have access to broadband. This is not something they're doing for their own personal gain. This is something that they're doing for the good of the committee and for the good of the community. And I just want to acknowledge all of the work that they're doing. We have now moved into three subcommittees. We're focusing on, one committee is focusing on funding options. The funding picture is changing so rapidly in this field that it's hard to know what's going to be available even a year from now, much less 5 or 10 years down the road. But this subcommittee is trying to get a handle on the various options that are out there and bring to us to be able to bring back to the legislature some options and or recommendations along that line. Another subcommittee is looking at all of the issues that have to do with deployment and the complexity of how we're going to get there. And another committee is looking at all the questions that have to do with educating the community so that when broadband is available, that people will know how to access it and how to use it, and also educating the community about the value of seeing to it that everybody in Tompkins County has access. If you already have access, I think sometimes it's easy not to think about how much of a detriment it is to the people who live, especially right now I'm thinking of school children who are growing up, perhaps living in some of the parts of our county where they don't have access, or they are families of low income and they can't afford to pay for access. So that's another part of what our committee is taking a look at. So I don't want to take an awful lot of time. We're busy, we're working, we're meeting, and I think things are going well. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat, and Dave for the service on that committee. It's such a big topic. And Paula, right, and very important for us. Anyone else? Carol, Will, Frank, Dooley.
Hi. I'd just like to remind people that single-stream recycling is going to start next week, March 7th, I think it is. You will now be able to just throw your recycling in one barrel. Do it. Recycle. It's good for the environment. It's good for our trash collection efforts, and it's good for your own household waste stream. So do it. And then I just want to report very briefly on a very lively discussion that we had at the TCOG Assessment and Land Valuation Work Group with some very kind representatives of the real estate attorneys came out, the Board of Realtors, quite a few realtors were there, and representatives from the local banks that have the largest market share in residential mortgage lending came. And it, you know, you don't have to have, it doesn't matter what your opinion is about gas drilling. We had a lively discussion about the kinds of impact that this is already having on residential lending and the ways in which it's impacting their work, out of which came other items too, but two specific items that the group sort of asked us to take to New York State. And one has to do with the requirement, a request to New York State that there be a requirement that all gas leases and changes to those gas leases in the form of memoranda be required to be recorded along with leases, along with property deeds. Either at the local level or even better at the state level in a clearinghouse. And the second would be the setback requirements that the DEC is talking about in their environmental impact statement doesn't really work for the banks. They cannot guarantee title unless they can sell their loans on the secondary market, and those need to conform to the usual Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other standards that require a larger setback than New York State is talking about. So it really will impact, and they've not only asked us to take that there, but have volunteered to be part of putting together what the information to take. So I thought that was interesting. If you have questions or thoughts on that, see me, and I'm happy to talk about it.
Thank you, Carol. Will?
Thank you, Martha. Last Friday was the 100th anniversary of the worst industrial accident in our state. I'm talking, of course, about the Triangle Shirtwaist fire that happened on March 25th, 1911, when an estimated 146 people died in a horrific fire. And these were mostly women working as seamstresses, making women's garments for very, 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 very poor wages, but on working conditions that were unimaginable. And I think it's important, and I'm taking your time to recall this, because we are seeing right now an assault on unions in our country that is unparalleled in my experience. Questioning the very value of workers coming together and negotiating the conditions in which they work. In the shirtwaist factory, you had women who literally were locked into a building 8 stories high, and when the fire broke out, they could not get through the doors, and they were literally forced to jump out of the building. And, you know, if we are doomed to repeat history that we forget, I urge us to keep in mind all the struggles that came before as the union struggles that are playing out now continue to be discussed. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Frank, and then Dooley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will, there was an excellent PBS special on just this last week about that. I've given NYSEG a break for a couple of months about not picking on them, but that's come to an end. I received a letter, and I suspect most of you did as well, from Iberdrola, NYSEG, that indicated that if you make your utility payments at a bank, as I do, they're no longer going to offer that option as far as taking your payment to the bank of your choice and one that will receive it. They've offered free e-bill service, electronic funds transfer, and, of course, mail, which is always subject to the postmark. The reason I bring this up, you know, I was torn between whether I should give this under my health committee report, but it's nothing that my committee discussed, so I'm doing it here on the privilege of the floor. We're dealing with social isolation of seniors. And I spoke with Lisa Holmes, our director of COFA, last week after I received this, and asked if there was an incident, if there was a concern about seniors being socially isolated. And she said, absolutely. There was a study done, and we're about hopefully to embark on another one. And you wonder why I raise this. The contact that most of our seniors may have is the post office, going to the grocery store, and perhaps going to the bank. And here's NYSEG foreclosing another one of those options, which really bothered me. So anyway, in trying to do something about this, I wanted to compliment Melissa Steinbach at Ithaca College. If any of you caught this article in the Ithaca Times a week or so ago, Melissa has started a group called Project Generations. She's rounded up 24, she's a junior, by the way, she rounded up 24 individuals who are working with our COFA department. And they're going out and seeing seniors, they're signing up, they're taking them to appointments or just having tea with them or sitting down and communicating with them. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing that we talk about where it's not costing us a nickel. And it's also, from a psychological standpoint, I think it's important, particularly for a group of seniors, that when Irene Stein, Peter may know that name, when Irene Stein was our COFA director, she did a study about, or had a study done about the fastest growing population in our county, and it was the individuals that were over 65 and up to 85, and that whole graph has now moved up. And as the population ages here, this is the kind of thing I think my committee's got to begin to pay some attention to, because I think if we're going to encourage people to come here, and I hear about housing rates and the cost of apartments and whatnot, and we're trying to do something with TCAT to bring transportation all over the community for everybody, this is the kind of thing we really need to be sensitive to. We can't have people trapped in their homes. And I wanted to compliment Melissa. If she was under 19, I would nominate her for the Distinguished Youth Award, but unfortunately, she is not. But I thought this was worthy of some acknowledgement, and also to bring to your attention that here's NYSEG again foreclosing another option for bill pay. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Julie, and then Mike.
Well, I have sort of half of an announcement and then something else I wanted to talk about. The announcement has to do with an alternative method of fracking, which is use of propane. It's something that has been used now in Canada. And a Cornell professor, whose name I can't remember, has invited someone to this community to speak on that, and I think it is Wednesday evening, but I don't know where or when. That's what I mean by half an announcement. Maybe somebody else on this group knows the rest of that. What I wanted to talk about, though, is a different item. Well, more than 2 years ago, in the last days of the Bush administration, there was a rush to auction off more of our federal lands in the West for oil and gas leasing. And pretty much on the spur of the moment, a college student, Tim DeChristopher, thought, this is wrong. These lands should be protected. And he went to the auction, and he signed in as a bidder. And they allowed him to, without doing the due diligence they should have, to see if he actually could afford to bid. So he bid, and he won several parcels. And that totally screwed up the bidding, the auction, so that nothing got sold. The Obama administration's Secretary of the Interior eventually took all those parcels off the auction block, so they are saved at the moment. But the Obama administration also decided that we can't let this go by, so they have put him on trial and want to make an example out of him, give him 10 years in jail for this. And the trial started yesterday in Salt Lake City and will go on for several days. I thought it was an amazingly heroic action by this young man and didn't want to lose sight of that.
Thank you, Dooley. Mike?
We lost two of our best and brightest this past weekend, as reported. A young student from Cornell University and a young student from Ithaca College. I find this particularly tragic if the reports of the paper are correct that they may have been alcohol-related deaths. We live in a time when alcohol seems to be the way of having a good time for everybody. It's something that costs us here in Tompkins County a lot of money, whether it's through the court system where alcohol is causing problems with families, through their mental health agencies, through our alcohol counseling and other things. It's a huge expense for our society. It's very similar to what happened with cigarette smoking, if you think about it. I hope sometime soon at the national level we begin to address the problem of alcohol and begin to start the 20-year period which it would take to change the mindset of people and how they have a good time. We're not going to be able to ever ban alcohol. I wouldn't even suggest that. But we don't ban cigarettes. But, you know, after 25 years of no advertising of it on television, a lot less people smoke than used to be. And maybe to protect the lives of our young people, we need to be doing things like that at the national and state level.
Thank you, Mike. Anyone else? Kathy and
Will? Thank you. I just want to take a minute to say how proud I am to be a union member tonight. And seeing the events that have happened in Wisconsin and really Ohio, Indiana, and all over the country these last few days, I've come to a better understanding, although not the understanding that I would have if I were able to go to these locations, as many young people from Cornell have gone and as many citizens of Wisconsin and the affected states have done. They've gone to their capital. They've gone to redress grievances. That's our right of assembly. And I want to say how proud I am of the union members and of the individuals who have stood up for their rights and who have tried to explain to all of us why this is important to everyone, regardless of whether you have a union affiliation or not. And I'd just like to ask the public and my colleagues for us to have an open mind as these discussions continue, because this is the basis of our democracy. The ability to get together as a group and redress grievances is key. And what's happening right now is historic. I've not ever seen anything like it in my life, and I'm told that since from over 50 years, we haven't seen anything like this. So if you get a chance, I know the media isn't covering this, but there's lots of coverage from independent journalists on the Internet and in other places. If you can use Google or Bing, you can find it. And the YouTube videos, very inspiring. The blogs that are coming out with pictures. My understanding is that there hasn't been any violence, despite reports that some of you may have heard on mainstream media. The little bit of coverage that has been available in mainstream media has been largely inaccurate. The young people that have been there, that have been blogging and Twittering and actually having live feeds, show an amazingly peaceful, spiritual, and democratic gathering of people that really understand what it's about being an American. So I'm just really proud, and I just wanted to take a minute to say thank you to those people and to say that your nation thanks you.
Thank you, Kathy. Will, and then Peter.
I totally agree with Kathy, so thank you for saying this so eloquently. I found the time and place on the presentation, which is hydraulic fracking with using propane. It's a speaker, Robert Letts, from Gas Track Systems. He'll be speaking on Wednesday, tomorrow night, actually, March 2nd at 7:30 at Culp Auditorium at the high school. Anybody's interested?
Thank you, Will. Quick on the draw. Peter?
That's what I was going to say. The professor at Cornell is Art Ruloff. I'm sorry, I can't. I have a conflict, and I can't go.
We all do.
What?
We have our retreat.
Oh, the retreat. Is that? Yeah, that's right. Right. I knew I had something. He called me up and asked me to come, and I looked at my calendar and said,
"Try not to characterize that as a conflict."
But in any case, I have an appointment to talk to Art afterwards to see what he said, and I will be happy to tell people what I learn at whatever time is appropriate.
Thank you, Peter. Anyone else? Well, I'd like to welcome Carl Haynes, president of TC3. Come on to the mic. We have a presentation this evening on the state of TC3. Carl comes bearing gifts.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Coming around is my annual President's Report. This, as you know, is a kind of a brochure form of a much more detailed report that I provide to the Board of Trustees each year. Just to give you a couple of highlights, it continues the format that we've been using recently, where we highlight our six major goals at the college, what our accomplishments have been in each case, and also some indicators that we've developed in terms of whether it gives us the best evidence that we can muster in terms of whether we're making progress and achieving any degree of success. Also note that last year the college had 8 of our faculty and staff honored by the chancellor for the chancellor's award winners, and they're highlighted in the report as well. What I'd like to do tonight is, first of all, just speak briefly to the budget. I'm sure you're curious about that, and I want to give you a brief overview on that. A lot yet to unfold about all that, so we'll be talking a lot more about that as time goes on. And the purpose of this isn't really a budget meeting anyway or whatever. But the other thing I want to do is share something with this group that I've been sharing with some others around town and with the other county as well. But the 10 things that I hope you'll find interesting and fresh about what we're doing at TC3. So I'm not going to say they're the top 10, because I could probably list 20 or 30, but anyway, these are 10 things, and I'll share those with you as well. With respect to the budget, the governor has cut our aid by 10%. As you know, we're funded on a per FTE basis, FTE meaning our full-time equivalent student. That aid is going from $2,260 per FTE to $2,034 per FTE. A year ago, this fall, in the fall of 2009, that rate was $2,675. So we've lost $641 or 24% of our base aid in a 15-month period of time, which covers two budget years. For TC3, that's $2.5 million. So we began adjusting last summer, and the Governor Patterson vetoed the Senate and Assembly support for community colleges. We knew we were going to have some real challenges ahead. In addition to that, 18% of this year's funding from the state is coming from stimulus monies, which we knew was going away. So we knew we had a real challenge. We developed four scenarios, and we developed a series of strategies to target the what we felt at that time was the worst-case scenario, keeping our fingers crossed that we'd wind up with something a little better. Interestingly enough, we came within 1% of that in terms of what the governor actually did come out with in, for community colleges. So bottom line, we were pretty well prepared. We had 9% cut in our employment base. That was 30 positions. We had excellent cooperation with all three of our unions in working out some early retirement incentives. We got 12 retirements. There were 8 vacancies for various other kinds of typical reasons, 3 terminations for various performance-related issues, and there were actually 7 layoffs among the 30. So in addition to that, there was 20% cut in our operational funds and our equipment and so on. So we at this point feel like we've got a fairly we're within about 100,000 or so with this extra percent that the governor's cutting us, assuming there's no restoration, which at this point we're not banking on. Two key points I think I want to make in all this. First of all, you know, we were very strategic in how we went about all this. There was obviously some pain and major challenges in terms of how we're going about the restructuring for the employees and at the college, but we did preserve our core services for students, and that's really what we should have been doing, okay, what we were doing. The challenges that we're experiencing, I believe, will have minimal or, if any, impact on the majority of our students. I hope that they would continue to enjoy the same level of excellence in terms of service at TC3 that they've come to expect. So how do we cope with this? How do you cut, you know, this level of support out of your budget and, you know, continue to improve? Because keep in mind, we are still growing. We had over a 10% bottom line growth in our enrollment base last year. This year looks to be something in the 4 to 5% range. I think the rate of growth is slowing down at the college. But nevertheless, we do continue to have an increased demand for our services. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this. I have a detailed 8 or 9 page report that I gave to the Board of Trustees, which is on our website if you want to see it. But basically, we've applied a lot of lean office initiatives, which I know you're doing here in the county as well. That's been very helpful to us. We've had a number of technical and software upgrades, relying much more on digital kinds of uses to do things like catalogs and master schedules and things of that sort. We've had a detailed review of all of our curricula in terms of our course offerings, addressing low enrollment programs and courses to try to achieve savings. And we've also, of course, done a lot of restructuring and reorganization of major functions such as our development office, counseling, library, and including my office. Okay, I've lost a half-time person, and I'm learning how to be more paperless and how I do things, which for an old guy like me is you know, a real challenge these days. But I am learning, and we're doing well. Of the 8 faculty vacancies, I would point out that of the retirements and vacancies we had there, there were 8, but we're sustaining 6 of those that will not be filled. We are going to fill 2 of those. We had 2 losses in our math department, 2 in our English, and those courses are so critical in terms of our liberal arts area and so on and foundation areas that we are going to fill 1 each in that area. And we are sustaining our commitment to small classes. Some of our colleagues around the state and around the country are growing class sizes to 70, 80, 100 and or more. And we just feel that's contrary to what we as a community college are about in terms of allowing our faculty to have the opportunity for to develop close relationships with the students. We believe it'll help our retention. And, of course, it's really important, I think, in terms of their educational experience. So we are not compromising on that. The second point I guess I want to make is our continued commitment, of course, to our economic and workforce development. We continue to look for opportunities to develop new programs. The Board of Trustees the other night developed a new program in digital cinema, another one in recreational fitness training. Programs there's virtually, I think, one or two new courses in both of those curricula because they rely heavily on repackaging existing curricula, rely heavily on, totally, I should say, really on current faculty talent, and yet we can offer an additional kind of opportunity for programs of interest to our students. In each of these cases, they happen to be some programs where students would transfer. In this regard, here's where I'll maybe put a little plug in for this program we're doing on Saturday or on Friday morning with the Chancellor. You all got an invitation to that. I know at least some of you, I think, were able to make it. If anybody would like to and you haven't responded yet, please let my office know. The Chancellor will be there to kind of lay out the SUNY strategic plan for how the SUNY is responding to the economic and workforce development needs of our community. And I'm kind of pleased to say also it's the first time that all four college presidents in the area are going to be in one place at the same time. So I'm kind of proud of that, actually. I think that's great. 10 things, okay, that hopefully, and I know you've got a busy agenda ahead, so I'll kind of just give you the brief highlights on these and then open it up to any questions that you might have on this or anything else. First of all, our global initiatives, that's not new. You know we've been doing a lot of things in the global arena for a number of years, but what you might not know is that we just recently were accepted by a group of six universities in Columbia to become a part of their network. And in Columbia, there's a real commitment on the part of the governors of some of the states there to make all of their higher education institutions bilingual. Okay, and of course, English being the other language. And if the students are going to become bilingual, the faculty need to be bilingual. And we have between 80 and 120 faculty coming, Columbian University faculty coming to the campus this summer to develop their language skills. So we have a new ESL institute to support that initiative. Technical areas, you know, we've won a lot of awards in the past in terms of how we use computing and so on to support instruction and so on. The Digital Center for Technology has given us those awards in the past. For a while, we were number one of the small colleges. And in the past, they've always recognized 10 community colleges in each of three categories, small, medium, large. This year, they rated everybody on a grading scale, A+, A, B+, and so on, of all categories, all sizes of institutions around all the community colleges in the country. There were only five that got an A+ rating, and your community college is one of them. So we feel real proud of that. You also know that we've been a leader in online delivery of educational services. What you might not know is that we have a pilot project underway right now with two or three faculty who are looking at developing online text resources as their go-to textbook, text resources for their classes. This might sound kind of easy. It's really a lot more to it than I could describe here tonight. But as we get experience with this and begin to roll this out, I think it's going to be a tremendous cost saving for students. I mean, students, are, as you know, textbook prices are just out of sight. This initiative, I believe, is going to go a long way. So we've got some faculty and our technical staff that are working on that. Resident Life Program, again, you know about that. What you might not know is that we've got a growing number of learning communities that are a part of the residence experience that our students have there. I also wanted to comment briefly on our incoming student where we have we're real focused now on working with high schools in a number of transition programs, helping students to make a smoother transition into college to, we believe, help their retention and ultimate success. We have a task force on the future underway right now. We had a retreat later this week, actually, to a college-wide retreat where we're going to be talking about some of the recommendations that this task force is making on how, you know, what are the one or two big ideas that we can develop and implement at the college to really ratchet up the graduation rate, the success rate of our students. You hear a lot about that in the media. You know, the Community College Summit down in Philadelphia yesterday, you know, was highlighting that. The President's Community College Summit last fall was a part of that. So we're on the case with that as well. Transfer students, again, you know, 55% of our students transferred to upper division colleges, which you might not know, is that we have the largest number of transfer students of any community college in the country that go to Cornell. And of course, you could say that's because of our proximity, but Cornell doesn't accept just anybody, okay? If you're not performing well and you're not academically prepared, you're not going to Cornell, and we're pleased to be recognized in that way. Our TC3.biz continues to do well. Our concurrent enrollment program just received full accreditation from the National Association of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships. We serve maybe 35 or 40 school districts in the region. Cortland Extension Center, up and running. But the building is coming up out of the ground, okay? We're under construction is what I intended to say. And we plan a grand opening there, we hope, in September. Well, I know it will be in September. I'm not going to equivocate on that. But construction is on schedule and going well. And number 10 in Keshewer County. We're applying for two grants that I think have a lot of potential. And actually, I want to credit Joe because some of the work you're doing here in Tompkins County is a little bit of an impetus for this. The grants are from the U.S. Economic Development Administration. If we're successful, they'll total about $140,000. And what we want to create with this grant support is a TC3 Center for Excellence in Government and Industry. It'll be an economic driver to work with municipalities, school districts, to discover organization-wide strategic efficiencies such as shared services, best practices. It'll be focused on both large and small, public and private organizations. And the work you already are doing here with the Lean Office is kind of a prototype of what we want to be able to offer to all kinds of municipalities and districts and organizations in the community. So that's the 10. I hope what you gain from this, and my feeling is that TC3 is not your plain vanilla community college. We increasingly are recognized nationally for much of what we do. Our global initiatives that I mentioned, our A-plus rating, we've been invited to participate in a major grant with some other colleges around the country on this online textbook idea, resident life program, our partnership with the Gallup organization. By the way, they awarded the Don Clifton Excellence Award. We were competing with 50 colleges and universities around the United States and Canada, and the award's only been given twice, and we were the first community college last summer to receive that award. So it's often heartening to me that when others, you know, who visit our campus or get to know us in some way, are both surprised and kind of delighted about what they find at the college, and I find that very heartening. So now, does this mean we don't have any problems or challenges? Of course not. There's much that we wish we were doing better. But my message really here for you this evening is that we're on the case, and that in spite of our budget woes, we have a solid base at the college for continuing to grow, prosper, and provide what we do in terms of services to our students and to our communities. So thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to take any questions that anybody might have.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Give us some numbers on the class size, what the largest is, the smallest is, what the average the student sees?
The smallest still could be, in some cases, kind of single digit, because we're required to offer some programs, and that's why we're really looking at some of our low enrollment programs, particularly in some of the career areas, the specialized career areas. But that's fairly unusual now because we're making some curricular changes there that we believe are going to help address some of those, and that takes a little time. The maximum is usually 30. Most of our classrooms, if you will, are structured for 30. I would say if you wanted to average it all together, we're somewhere in the low 20s, probably. Something like that.
Any other questions? Carol.
Do you have a sense of the percentage of students who might not have access to those online course materials from home? And if not here, I hope that you'll be willing to share information with our broadband committee. You could submit them to Pat Pryor, who chairs that committee.
Probably you could answer that question better than I, because I don't know. But obviously the students, if they want to access from home and they're in the rural areas, we know that's a problem. I've got staff, okay, that have those kinds of issues. What we are trying to do is address it, though, really on campus, okay, where, not only with our computers we make available, just in our labs and open labs as well as the classroom-based labs. But we also have kind of a program that we're expanding a little bit in our learning commons where, you know, there's laptops here that students can loan out and borrow for 2-3 hours at a time or whatever. So, and the same kind of availability in our extension centers. You know, we're seeing a real uptick here in our TC3 Tioga Place Center, and it's one of the reasons why we're expanding our center in Cortland to have more of those open kind of labs, make it easier for our students who are in either who can get to Cortland or get to downtown. They get easier than they get to our campus to have the same availability. So the availability is there, but I'm not sure the college has the capacity to address the issue for people who want to access it at home. But our zeal and the direction that I believe we're going in an education period, I probably shouldn't even say just higher education, okay, with the kinds of packaging of online resources that can support faculty courses, the faculty-driven courses and so on, and their work is an important part of whatever case you try to make there, I would think.
Mike?
Carl, there was recently a report out of Syracuse about TC3 and some of the residents' life issues, particularly how you're working with students to improve civility. Did you want to comment on that?
Sure.
I thought it was a nice report.
Yeah, it was. It was a very well done report. We had an incident in our resident life back in December that involved some Cortland young people and so on. But what we've developed, and I think is really grabbing hold, and it kind of speaks to the point you raised earlier about the unfortunate loss of a couple students here in the area just over the weekend. You know, we've got a real focus on Panther pride, okay? You know, we got these a whole bunch of little armbands and other kinds of initiatives on campus to try to encourage people to take pride not only in the community on campus, okay, but how they connect with the community at large. And, you know, we've got a broad range of people on campus from both our substance abuse office, our counseling office, our resident life office, student activities offices and others working collaboratively with people from the communities, okay, whether it's law enforcement or others, to I guess kind of address these issues in a collaborative kind of way. We obviously had some discussions about this after this past weekend, and our folks have been really working very closely with folks at Cornell and Ithaca College. We believe they have really prototype programs, okay, to try to address and or prevent these kinds of issues, and yet something like this still happens. And it just kind of speaks to the point that I think you or someone else was making here tonight, that it's such a sad and challenging kind of situation that something like this happens, and yet there's lots of resources around to try to wish you could prevent it, have prevented it in some way. But anyway, we went on red alert, really, you know, on our campus with following the weekend's incidents, with reaching out to that with people.
Thank you very much, Carl. I was actually going to ask something like that. I really appreciate hearing that. It takes a village. I mean, we really want to make sure that kids, as they, you know, spread their wings, they really are. They have a net under them, I guess.
Well, we've got our coordinator of alcohol and substance abuse at the campus just doing a terrific job with this. He's got this 10-point program, which has been adopted by many universities around the country. We're in our second year of rolling that out on campus. He not only meets individually people, with groups of students and so on to try to, just help develop awareness. And of course, again, the experiences this weekend become another reason to get people together and talk about these things so that they can hopefully develop a little more sensitivity and sensibility about how they're using substances.
Thank you so much. Will.
Carl, thank you for coming down. And as always, I'm excited to hear the things that are happening at TC3. It's something that I think we all can take great pride in, that we have such an institution in this county. I was, however, a little surprised at the ease with which you seem to be taking a $2.5 million hit to your budget. Is what, about $35 million or something? That is huge, and I applaud your ability to roll with it and try to make the best of it and put the best possible face. But I'm wondering what you are hearing for the future moving into subsequent budget years. You know, can you do this multiple times, or is this about it?
It's interesting that your observation was that I worked into that easily. It wasn't easy. It was painful. And maybe it's just because it's largely behind us that I'm kind of sensing relief in some respects. Some of my colleagues are now just starting the work that we did last summer and then into the fall. And I don't want to suggest that, you know, if you look at the report that I gave to the board that's on our website, you know, some of these things are still a work in progress. We're still trying to figure out how some of these adjustments are going to be made and so on. It's interesting that I was commenting to someone today, you know, I'm no longer worried about 11-12, I'm worried about 12-13. And I'm looking for signals at the state level to try to figure out, you know, is this problem going to be resolved now? Are we really kind of on top of it or not? And we got to look forward to more of this kind of thing. If we have another round of this in another year, it's not going to be. And I don't want to say it was easy. But we don't have much more that we can cut before you start really having to start denying access to students. And the California system's been doing that. You see it happening out there. One of the districts out there has turned away 20,000 students this past year. The way their funding cycle works there is that, you know, it's not on a per-student basis. It's just an allocation, so they just stop admitting students. And that's just one district, one big district. I think it was the San Diego district. So... we're beginning to shift a little bit of thinking about revenue generating. You know, how can we, you know, what can we do to kind of grow revenue to kind of offset if we do get any more? But those discussions are very preliminary right now. And oftentimes those kinds of ideas are short term in terms of their success. So I'm very concerned about 12-13. I think we're in pretty good shape without having to... take any drastic actions as far as 11-12 is concerned at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carl. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for all of your ongoing support, too. It really is very important to us. Couldn't do it without you.
Thanks. Good luck with the rest of it. For my report tonight, a couple of sort of disparate things. I had my first day with the Undoing Racism workshops that two and a half days started today. And I found it very interesting, a terrific group of folks there and wonderful presenter. I just want a shout out to Jackie Thomas, Andrea Gibbs, and Kevin Sutherland in administration who were also there, and a woman named Penny something in for mental health, and I can't remember what her last name was, but... those are the county employees who are just at that one session. There may be others at the other sessions as well. Joe and I were in a meeting yesterday, having a meeting, just our own weekly meeting, and got a call back from Steve Aquario and Dave Lucas at NYSAC. We called and asked that we could reach out and have a conversation with them about what we were seeing. And Since this body last met, the Medicaid redesign team came out with its report on recommendations last Thursday, 5 days early. And I believe the Medicaid redesign and mandate relief team is probably releasing its report today. Steve Aquario was on both of those. The mandate redesign team, it looks as though we will see some direct cuts in terms of reimbursement for mental health and I think home health. Is that right, Joe?
Yes.
And we're very concerned that it does appear as though any savings will probably be realized by New York State and not by counties on Medicaid. I do understand that the mandate relief team is supposedly looking at the idea of the state picking up the expenses for Medicaid. Who knows if that'll actually survive in the proposal. I will say that Steve said that task force has really hardly met, and it has felt as though it was extremely top-down. They were not nearly as engaged as the Medicaid redesign team had been, which they solicited ideas from public hearings and on the web. The Medicaid group had something like 4,000 ideas that they sifted through. We will say, I think they were sifted through by the governor's office and then handed to the team, and they made some changes, but at least that process was a bit more open and inclusive. So, you know, as of today's March 1st, maybe a month from now we will have a budget. I think the forces are really moving in that direction. So our message to Steve was, counties got to show up. We have to be in the halls of the Capitol. Please call us there soon. And Steve was saying, well, you know, we don't know what's happening. Well, in a couple weeks, we'll let you know. I said, no, you have to send a message out now that says, you know, plan to be in Albany March 16th, and then people can make some plans. So I haven't seen an email to that effect yet. I really do hope that NYSAC organizes something so that we have a press conference and, you know, at least there are some warm bodies there and real stories that we can tell to our legislators as they're chewing all this over. Related to that, I was one of the 40 Democrats, or more than 40 Democrats, who signed the letter to the governor. It was reported on the on some press that we were opposing cuts to seniors and to children. In fact, it wasn't simply don't cut services, but it was taking a stand on the tax for the wealthy, the surcharge, and really saying that if you that to uphold as party members of the same party, we're asking that, you know, the values of the Democratic Party really demand that we see shared sacrifice. So that was part of that letter as well, not just the cuts. I just want to pass around. Joe, you're going to talk about the retreat?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to pass around the card that we received. Remember, we sent letters to the victims of the Arizona shooting, and I wanted to pass a card that we received from Judge Roll's wife. And I have an appointment for the Civil War Commission, Simon St. Laurent. So that is my report. Okay. Any questions? Okay. County Administrator Joe Mariano.
Thanks, Martha. I'm going really short tonight. I think the committee chair is going to cover some things that might otherwise have been in my report. I just want to remind you the retreat is tomorrow night. It's at 5:30. And I wanted to remind you where it is. It'll be at the Health Department. We expect it to go a couple of hours. Two topics. One is how do we better communicate what we do and the value of what we do. The second is the topic of sustainability. Ed Marks is going to lead us through that. There will be food. I know that's an issue, so we will talk about that. But anyway, tomorrow night, 5:30 for the retreat. That's it.
All right. Thank you. County Attorney Jonathan. Oh, I'm sorry. Any questions for Joe? All right. County Attorney Jonathan.
I'll be even.
Oh. One question for Joe.
Sure.
Joe, I'm sorry. I should have asked Martha, but when is the – I've been collecting newspaper articles on the Medicaid on this commission that you – or a member of. Do you know when this final report is going to be issued so we can actually review it? All we're getting is anecdotal stuff.
Well, we can pull down right now, if not the report, then at least a summary of the report. And those departments of ours that receive Medicaid reimbursements are looking at those recommendations now to see what impact it may have on their reimbursement stream. Arthur was right. We already know that the CHA is going to be affected. That was one of the early items. What we really need to zero in on now is in the mental health area. All told, the county receives upwards of $4 million in Medicaid reimbursements because we are a direct provider of services, and we bill Medicaid for those services. So what we're doing right now is going through the specific changes that have been proposed to see how they may affect our Medicaid reimbursement stream, especially in mental health. That'll take a few days. If the legislature would like, whatever I can find that's now published, I can send out to members of the legislature for you to see.
Well, since the departments have come through my committee, are probably going to be, and the agencies are going to be mostly affected. Well, they'll be certainly affected. I'd appreciate that. One of the reasons I'm asking is that in the articles I've been reading, there's a proposal to change the rate of reimbursement, and there's a hidden, we're going to pass any other shortfall onto the counties. I mean, is there any, between you and Martha, is, have you had any indication that we're going to get walloped through the side door?
The wallop part, I don't know. Again, if our Medicaid reimbursement rates go down for services that mental health provides, that's a cost shift. Because, for example, if it's our clinic and someone arrives at our clinic who needs help, we will provide that service, and if less money comes from Medicaid, that means that the money has to come from someplace else. And these days, about the only other place is property tax or cutting other services. So that will certainly have a backdoor effect on us that makes the property tax cap even more onerous. But again, we need to go through it, and Bob DeLuca and his staff are the experts to go through it and see how that might affect us.
Well, I think Martha is absolutely right that it makes the state look like heroes, and it's going to make us look a little, well, not foolish, but like the robber barons if we have to raise the taxes to cover the shortfall you were mentioning.
Well, and I don't think we'll have, well, we would have the ability to raise taxes if we get a supermajority of this board of 10 out of 15 votes to go over the cap. That's what it would take.
Well,
so once again, we have the honor of having the responsibility.
But I understand that there's a other phraseology further down that says something about having to do something with a referendum in order to achieve that two-thirds majority.
Yeah, let me speak to that quickly. It came up at TCOG because at the Association of Towns meeting last week or the week before, their reps told them that there was language in the tax cap bill that would require a referendum buried in the fine print. In fact, there is. And you know that we have been reading the law, and as has NYSAC, in the section that talks about how do you override the cap, we read the section that says it's two-thirds of the legislature. Buried in the fine print is a cut and paste from the school district language that says it's subject to a referendum. So as soon as we heard that from the towns, we called NYSAC and asked them what's going on. They have talked to the sponsors of that legislation who acknowledge that that bill was put together in some haste, that was a mistake. It was a cut and paste out of the school section. They know that our budgets aren't subject to a vote of any kind, the schools are. So in the cleanup, if there is a cap, it's expected that this will be cleaned up. This isn't the only problem in that bill. There's also a reference to a carve-out for capital expenditures, but it reads like a school district. There's a carve-out for voter-approved capital projects or something like that. School districts have their capital projects approved by the voters. Counties don't. Cities don't. So it was hastily prepared, and if there is a cap, let's all hope that there is serious cleanup done to make sure that these things are fixed.
Well, I want to personally, I mean, I think Martha and you deserve a vote of thanks for serving on. I know it, to get that thing together as quickly as you did, I know it took a lot of time and a lot of reading. However, doesn't OTB look better and better?
Yeah, right. To be clear, I wasn't on the governor's mandate, either of those teams. I was on the NYSAC group.
The NYSAC group.
Yeah, and Dave Lucas mentioned just one other quick thing, that their position, they're trying to lobby to have a tax cap postponed until our next budget so that there would be time to see whether any of the mandate reforms would actually save us money. So that would certainly be a big relief if that were
The state budget in 2012.
That the tax cap would not apply to our 2012 budget. It would take effect in 2013, which would give time for changes in mandates to actually, show up if they do.
When are they up for election? 2013.
I guess so.
Just thought I'd ask.
Peter.
What an odd coincidence.
Yes.
Peter.
Of all the things that I've heard in this room, I think the last one that slipped out of Joe's mouth is the most terrifying thing I've ever heard, that the way legislation seems to be written in Albany, there's less care taken with it than, I think, than we take when we write out these resolutions, where we ponder over each sentence and look at them and argue about it, cut and paste from one thing to the other and not even knowing what's in there. I mean, I'm utterly shocked. I'm not exaggerating. I find that frightening. End of comment.
Frightening, true, shocking. I'm not sure I agree with that, but thank you for pointing it out, Peter. All right, thank you, Joe. Jonathan Wood.
No report.
Thank you. David Squires, Finance Director.
Two quick things. We started the year off with sales tax on a positive note. January sales tax were up for the county about 4.8%. So and the other thing I wanted to report on is the consortium, which had been inching along, is now up to speed. And to give you an example, in the first month of activity, the consortium, which the finance department is the fiscal agent for, we took in, you know, $2 million of premiums and paid out $500,000. Slow to pay claims because the billing process set up with the vendors. But in February, we took in over $2 million, and we paid out over $2 million. So it's, you know, we're seeing it ramped up now, and it's going to be an interesting process. One thing that's interesting to me, and Joe and I were talking about it, is, you know, this concept of everybody's belittling government employees because they're massive, you know, they're outsized benefits. You know, in all these other states where there's a lot going on, we look pretty good in terms of we have responsible programs where there is a significant payment by employees for their benefits. And in the consortium, you would have to say the Tompkins County benefit is probably on the lower end of the benefits among the municipalities. The smaller the entity, the richer the benefit, it appears. And the county probably has higher copays than any of the other. So that was very interesting. And just so the fact, all these other states where the cries are going out, employees pay next to nothing. New Jersey, you probably saw the big article in the Times about they were paying 1.5% of payroll for health insurance, 1.5% of their salary. We pay 20% of the premium. It's a big difference between percentages, salary, than 20% of a premium of a benefit. So there is significant cost sharing.
Thank you, David. Any questions? Jim.
It's a comment. I've been reading a lot about Wisconsin and all these other states, and that's what struck me, that the significant level of contribution by other public employees is shockingly small compared to New York State and compared to even clearly this county. And I think the demonizing of public employee unions is the wrong way to go. And people have to begin to think about productivity and parity before they can just throw public employee unions away and recognize what they've done and what they will do in the future if they structure themselves correctly. And that's what the challenge is, I think, for public employee unions to do.
Well, and certainly as we know in all of our negotiations with our own unions that benefits and salary are sort of fungible. You end up trading one for another. So it's you know, if somebody has a relatively rich benefit, they're likely to be paid less on the salary side. So, all right, anything else for David? Thank you very much. Are there any resolutions to be removed from or withdrawn or added to the agenda, Pam?
Yes, I'd like to, everybody should have in their folder, Resolution I,
approval of contract between the county and the Chamber of Commerce Convention and Visitors Bureau for Tourism. I so move. I took this off the agenda last time, and it didn't get put back on this time, and I would like to do so at this time.
Is there a second for that? Pat seconds. It needs 10 votes to be added to the agenda, and as Pam said, it was just an error that it didn't get added on. So all in favor of adding this to the agenda, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
Consent agenda. I have a number of appointments, and there are two resolutions authorizing the county administrator to... Okay. Approval of appointment resolution B, approval of appointment to the Tompkins County Council of Governments. Lesnar, you said off? Okay. The appointments are Library Board of Trustees, Bruce Ryan, Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Betsy Doling, Criminal Justice Advisory Alternatives to Incarceration Board, Ken Lansing, Stop DWI Advisory Board, Ken Lansing, Local Emergency Planning Committee, Ken Lansing, and Traffic Safety Committee, Ken Lansing, Emergency Communications Review and Oversight Committee, Ken Lansing, Brian Wilbur, Peter Stein, and Leslie McBean Claiborne, Personal Emergency Response Service Advisory Board, Ken Lansing, Advisory Board on Indigent Representation, Diane Bruns, Family Court Advisory Council, Virginia Metcalf, and Diane Withiam. I have a motion on those. Frank moves, or a second? Peter seconds. All in favor of the consent agenda, was just the appointments. Please raise your hand. Any opposed? That is unanimous. So I would like to do a little juggling here, and I would ask Jim Dennis, Budget and Capital Committee, to take up Resolution C, and not your whole report. We'll come back to you, but we have people in the audience to concerned about that, if you don't mind.
I will do that, and I also had at the committee an item today about the creation of the investigator position, and do I have to add that at this point, or?
No, that's on the agenda.
That's on, okay. So I would, in your folder, you had yellow number C, endorsement of legislative bills, Senate 3174, Assembly 4697, authorizing a 25-cent per $100 mortgage recording tax on obligation secured by a mortgage on real property, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Dooley seconds that, and this is the revised version that did go through committee.
It is the revised version.
Any discussion? Pat.
I just wondered, Jim, since you chaired the committee and you're more familiar with this than I am, but I do recall from the discussion that if this does get enacted, that this would bring Tompkins County to the point that many of her counties are already at. Could you just speak to this
yes,
a little bit?
Yes, I have a list of things, and let me just quickly run through it about this resolution. First of all, this resolution is not allowing us to increase the mortgage tax. It is allowing us to, if the state legislature passes it, we would have to come back and do it again. But let me just say, it's paid by the borrower. The current rate is 0.75%. So on a $100,000 mortgage, the tax is now $750. What we're asking for is 25 cents. It would increase $250. So $100,000, it would cost you $1,000 on a mortgage. The revenue from the tax now goes to the municipality where the real estate is located, 0.5%, and to the State of New York Mortgage Authority, Sony May, at 0.25%, Sony Ma. We have requested a 0.25% increase in the rate, adding $250 to the tax on a $100,000 mortgage, with the proceeds going to the county for general purposes, e.g., property tax relief. 47 of the 57 upstate counties already have recording taxes of 1% or more. The additional 0.25 is projected at last year to yield $900,000. Raising the same amount through property taxes would require 2.2 increase in our property taxes. To estimate the property tax impact, we now divide the amount raised by 406,000 versus the 380K last year, reflecting the increase in the 2011 levy that we did. Last year, the Assembly passed the Home Rule Bill, but it was embargoed by the Senate leadership. This year, we're asking both houses to pass it, and hopefully the governor may sign it.
Thank you, Jim. Anyone else? Pam.
I'm going to vote for this tonight because I think that what we're doing is the resolution asks state legislature to allow us the right to pass a resolution introducing this extra quarter of a percent. I'm not at all sure if I will vote for that when it comes to that time, if we ever get that home rule authorization from the state legislature. But I am going to support this so that we can move forward. Frankly, I would rather we entice the state into continuing not reducing the income tax for the various wealthiest people in our state is, to me, a fairer and better way for this our problems to be dealt with. So if we can manage to get the state to do that, hopefully we won't have to pass this particular mortgage recording tax if and when it comes back to us.
Thank you, Pam. Leslin, and then Frank. Okay.
Thank you. I might just struggle with this, but I understand the position we're in. I'm not sure if my vote will fall down. Can you say again?
I'm sorry, that's my fault.
Oh,
I apologize.
The 0.75, where does it go in?
0.25 of the increase in the rate. I'm sorry, let me see. The revenue from the tax now goes to the municipality where the real estate is located, 0.5%, and to the state of New York, 0.25%. So going to, by adding that extra 0.25%, that will come to us.
So right now we don't get any of it.
We'll get half.
No, we get
don't
half.
Get any of it now.
No, the municipalities get the half. The county government doesn't get anything.
The county out. Does, and right. The municipality in which the sale occurred gets that.
Where the property is.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Frank, and then Kathy.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Joe, why are we having to take this up again? This body has already expressed its interest in doing this. The state has said more or less, at least the Senate has said, we're not going to be considering any new taxes. Has their position changed, or is there some time reason, some legal reason why we have to pass something like this again?
Well, first, it's a new legislature. So we did ask for this identical piece of legislation a year ago, and that sat in Albany. The Assembly approved their bill. The Senate didn't. So that legislature is now gone. So you have to start the process all over again. And the way the process works is we have now asked them for this consideration again. They've given us a draft of the state legislation that would enact that change. They're basically asking this legislature right now, is this what you want? Is this the language you want? We now have to tell them that this is the language we want, and then the full body will consider it. Your question is whether circumstances have changed in Albany where we stand a better chance of passage this time than last time. It's probably too early to tell. The whole, read my lips philosophy still seems to be out there. At the same time, at some point, a certain level of realism, I think, has to affect thinking in Albany. And if local governments lose the latitude to make their own decisions about the best mix of revenues for their own situation, then there are some real significant consequences that will result from that. I think a part of our pitch, and maybe the most compelling part, is this is home rule. These are decisions that we think are best made at the local level. We're asking you to do that. So we will push that as hard as we're able, as will NYSAC, as will at least, there are at least 12 other counties asking for legislation similar to or identical to what we are asking for right now.
Thank you.
Kathy, Leslin, Carol.
Thank you. I don't like the mortgage recording tax. Prior to when it came to us a year ago, whenever it had come to us before, I always voted against it. One of the proudest moments in my life was when I was able to buy a home. It was something that in the past was completely out of my reach, and I understand the pride that can come with the ability to own a home and how it builds communities. I recognize the points that Bob Spaulding made on the part of the Ithaca Board of Realtors, and I think that there can be a real danger in us putting too much of a burden on the mortgage recording tax. Having said that, I'm here to tell you that last time, a year ago, when we were considering this, we were looking ahead and seeing that it was going to be really tough. We didn't even know how tough. And I voted for it because the prospect of what was then, I'm not sure what it's projected at now, $900K roughly, was something that, although it's going to squelch possibly the dreams of some people in the short term to be able to buy homes, it's going to enable some hungry children to be able to eat. We're having to juggle worse against much worse here. And in this budget, last year when I voted in favor of the mortgage recording tax. And depending on what happens, I don't hold out much hope that the extension on a tax surcharge on the wealthy New Yorkers is going to pass. I really encourage those of y'all that believe that it might to continue working for it, and I know I'll support it, but I need to hang my hat on this because we need the money. So I'm going to vote for it. It doesn't mean that in the future, and I'll vote to bring this forward. If something changes radically between now and the time that it happens, hey, I'll be so quick to tell you that I'm not supporting it. But in fact, I think this is a pragmatic and realistic response to the tough times we're in. So I'll vote for this tonight, and looking forward, unless things change drastically, I'll probably vote for this in the future. But not forever, just this time.
Thank you, Kathy. Leslie, and then Carol.
So I'm not one to ask silly questions, and this might be the silliest question in record. Yeah. Can we, in this, all this talk of property tax cap and the potential that that's going to happen, can we ask the state to share that 0.25% that they get with us, that we get half of that, as opposed to putting a new tax on people in our county who are really hurting? Don't have to answer that now. It isn't a short answer.
We can ask. The state, I'm sure, would say it is going to promote home ownership in the state because it's going to the state mortgage agency or authority, whatever it is, to help provide loans for housing. We can ask.
I'd like to see committee consider us asking.
Jim? My only answer to that would be I would love to ask, but be the second question we ask after them approving the mortgage tax, our request before. You know, I think we could do both at the same time, but they're certainly not going to.
Okay, well, my request is just to ask that first part of it, so that's just where I am.
What we have asked is that they get out of the business of these.
Which would be ideal, but see, I'm being compromising.
Right.
So, you know, just 50% is all we're asking for.
We've asked
of your quarter.
Thank you. The authority to be made permanent up to certain, whatever the levels are, and then they get out of the business of micromanaging what we do.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Carol.
We have heard from realtors who are concerned about the effect that this might have on sales. And should the state allow us this discretion, home rule, and should we then decide to implement an actual recording tax. You gave some figures at the Budget Committee meeting, Joe, about the sort of relative effect that this might have on Tompkins County versus the surrounding counties, or where this puts us in relation. So that, speaking to the concern of, would this put us at a disadvantage relative to surrounding counties in home sales?
Yeah, I think Jim cited the statistic. Right now there are 45 counties out of the 57 upstate counties who already have a mortgage recording tax of 1% or more. And again, this would take us to 1%. So we would be the 46th of 57 counties to have a mortgage recording tax rate of 1% or more. So we're certainly well within the pack.
Is the remaining county adjacent to us?
I don't think so. I may have that.
57 state counties, and we would be the 46th.
Okay. Well, if we get there, I don't need the answer now, but if we ever get to implementing this, that's a question I would ask.
Okay. Are we ready to vote? All right. All in favor of revised resolution C, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Opposed? 1, 2, 3. That passes 11 to 3. All right. Thank you, Jim. I would like to move to, if you don't mind, Pam, your resolution I. And then we'll go to public safety and the resolution E.
This is resolution I, approval of contract between the county and the Chamber of Commerce, Convention and Visitors Bureau for tourism services, and I so move.
Is there a second? Carol seconds that.
This is basically a renewal of the contract that we've had with the Chamber of Commerce to implement and oversee, administer the tourism funds for the Arkham Visitors Bureau and Convention Center. And it is, Joe is the one who negotiated it, so he could certainly answer questions about it. And Gene McFeeters, the Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce, is also here if people have questions to be directed at her.
Thank
you. I think you need a second, too, sorry.
Oh. It was seconded by Carol. Yeah. Thank you, Pam. Frank?
Are we up to questions?
Yes, we are.
Okay. I'm not opposed to having a contract with the Chamber. It's just I'm a little puzzled. We negotiated a 2-year contract with the Chamber that was supposed to, and this does say that it's supposed to end this year in December. My recollection is that the reason that we did it for the 2-year period was to provide time to hire the individual that we're receiving some funding for through the tourism board that's going into the planning department. And I realize that that's stalled a little bit for one reason or another, that we haven't hired, maybe as of today we have, I don't know the answer to that, but the planning committee meeting we hadn't hired anybody yet. What I'm curious about is this contract doesn't expire till the end of the year. Was there any discussion, and I'm sorry, Pam, I didn't bring a lot of this up at the planning committee meeting because we had a full agenda that day. Can we delay this for a short while until we hire somebody? Or is there a possibility that we need to go a whole 5 years on this particular contract? My recollection was we wanted to get some data together and have some history with this person that would be in the planning department to see if we, you know, how that was working, basically. So my question is, do we have to go the whole 5 years? Does this have to be done tonight? And perhaps Joe can answer some of those.
Do you want to go ahead?
If you don't, I'd be happy to. First of all, the reason there was a 2-year contract last year, which is a departure from history. Historically, these contracts have been 5-year blocks.
Right.
last year, as you recall, we were uncertain about where this new tourism coordinator, for the lack of a better word, how it might be defined, how it would kind of be involved in this whole relationship between us, the chamber, and others who were in the tourism business. So it was really to buy time for us to define what that relationship was going to be, which we have since done. And that was what came through PDEQ several months ago and led to the position of the budget and so forth. So in terms of the involvement of that position, there is no uncertainty anymore. That's been defined by basically this legislature. So the understanding last year was, even though it was a short-term two-year agreement, in good faith, we would sit down with the chamber quickly and negotiate a new five-year contract. The reason for that was, once we established this relationship, the mystery goes away. And second, the short-term nature of our contract with the chamber and through the chamber, the CVB, was creating some real anxieties within the CVB about what their future may hold. And that certainly wasn't our intent when these discussions began. So, consistent with the resolution, we did sit down with the chamber. We have negotiated a new five-year contract that is subject to your approval tonight. That contract basically continues the new plain language approach that we created last year in terms of how the accounting is presented to the legislature for approval at budget time. So there's no uncertainty at all about where money is going, including overhead costs to the chamber. That contract will include references to the new tourism coordinator and how that coordinator will be a part of the process of reviewing proposals that come in from the CVB and interacting with the CVB on the development of proposals. What else is in here that's important?
Does it guarantee a dollar?
Well, that's my third note here.
Okay.
That's really important for you to know what this contract isn't and has never been. It's never been an allocation of money. It's never been a guarantee of money or anything like that. It says, to the extent that this legislature agrees to give the chamber $1 for the promotion of tourism, here's how the mechanics of that will work. Here's the business relationship that will govern the way that money is requested, is spent, and reported on by the chamber and the CVB. Here's what it can be spent for and what it can't be spent for. In terms of the money allocations, and that's really what's important to you, I think, every year at budget time, you have to review that budget. And the only amount of money that will come to the chamber and CVB from this contract is what you approve at budget time. Our goal through this new contract is to make it easier for you at budget time to understand how that money will be spent, where those dollars will go. And I think we've accomplished that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Les, on the Pam, you want to answer?
Can I just add something to what Joe said? Is that I just want to make sure everybody understands that the money that's being used here is money that's collected from the room tax. This is not coming out of the general fund. This is all money from that room tax.
Thank you, Pam. Leslie?
Okay, I have two questions. One is, didn't I not see this before, like our last meeting, and it was pulled? Was there a reason why it was pulled?
It was pulled because Jean Peters is out of town, and I felt it was
important
to
That's
have
fine.
Her here.
That's fine. But my second question, though, Joe, I'm even more confused because I was going to ask about the money. There is a money approval that we do for the Convention and Visitors Bureau, which is part of the chamber.
Right.
Is that what you're referencing, that we approve at budget time,
yes,
that money?
That's correct.
Thank you.
This is, here's how you can ask for the money, here's how you have to report on it after you've been given it, here's the budget process and the reviews that would occur, but every year budget time, a request is presented to you for funding through the room tax. You then approve it. You, through the committee and the full legislature, must approve the allocation of money.
Okay. I'm still a little off, but that's okay. Thank you.
I'll say, okay. Kathy, then Carol.
Thank you. So I'm getting the impression that the question that I usually ask, which is how much, is not going to be answered in here because
right,
we're not talking about a specific line item. We're talking about a contract. For the purposes of putting this in perspective, because I know the chamber has historically done an exemplary job of marketing tourism for us, in the past, what percentage could we say of the room tax have chamber accounts in the aggregate amounted to, because I think that proportion will really help us get an idea of what we're talking about.
I think it's roughly half. Gene, is the number around 800,000? I didn't bring the numbers.
The number usually has been about $800,000. If you looked at the entire pool of room tax monies, the county gets 10%. The rest is split into a 60-40 pool. The 60% of that 90% is for marketing, and the chamber CVB generally gets about 55 to 65% of those funds.
What does that translate into dollars, Gene? Do you know?
About $800,000.
And the total room tax collections are about $1.7 million. If that helps.
So another way of looking at it would be a return on investment that's not bad in today's market. If you want to think of it that way for building our community.
Thank you, Kathy. Carol?
Yeah, I think some of what I was going to say has been said. I just want to make it clear that the county contracts with the chamber to administer the marketing part of our program. In a similar way, we contract with other agencies to deliver other pieces of our tourism program, and we are expanding with our own staff the part of the tourism program that that will deliver develop and deliver additional program portions of our tourism program. But the marketing piece is one that the chamber has really done an invaluable job over the years building up this program, establishing it, and overseeing the work that Fred Bond does and the CVB. And I, Gene, you know, has overseen that and helped to develop. It was what was her name? Brett, not Brett. Bridget, and then Fred to develop a marketing program that has really vastly increased the overnight visitors. And I don't see any reason to change that now or in the foreseeable, 5 years that we're talking about to continue this contract. I do have concerns that the chamber continue to develop other parts of our, you know, its own economic development, small business support for, businesses in Tompkins County, and that, now that this is more established, that it'll run and you'll be able to do additional things too in the fine way that you've done this.
Thank you, Karen.
I wholeheartedly support this.
Thank you. Before somebody calls the question, which might happen soon, I have a question. I think we have a typo on dates. The fourth whereas, I'm confused, says the current contract will expire December 31st, 2011, and then the resolve says that the contract is for January 1st, 2011.
Right. It's actually not a typo. It's saying we think this contract form is better and more relevant to what we have in place today with the tourism coordinator and so forth. So let's make it apply right now.
I see. Okay, so the current contract actually does go for the rest of the year. It's
right.
Not that we're out of contract.
That's correct.
Got it. Thank you. Oh, what do you know? All right. Leslie.
No,
then
I'm
Brian.
Not calling it a question. I just heard from Pam that Joe just did a stellar job negotiating this. Where's the contract?
Contract was distributed at PDEQ, so the committee members saw the contract at PDEQ. If you'd like a copy of it, I can email it to you. I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, the draft contract.
Thank you.
Yes, fine.
All right, I got Brian, Peter, Kathy, Dooley.
No, I was asking for a contract.
Oh,
email.
Brian.
Allow me. I'd just soon call the question.
Is there a second?
I just soon second it.
All those in favor of calling the question, please raise your hand.
No.
Any opposed? That passes 10-4. So it is time to vote on resolution I. Please raise your hands if you're in favor. 1, 2, 3, 4. Peter?
Yeah.
Okay. Any opposed? That passes unanimously.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the responsibility that you give us.
Thank you. Thanks for the great job that you do. Peter Stein, Chair of Public Safety, I would like to ask, and again, we're just doing resolutions. We'll go back through the order for your appointments. Could you take us through Resolution E, please?
Yeah, I have a question of protocol. Is this the place where I'm supposed to report on the committee, or will that happen at a different
time? No, that's what I'm saying. Let's just do the resolutions. Okay. Then we'll go back through the order of committees.
Okay, well, I would like to move resolution in the white paper resolution, not the yellow paper resolution.
All right. I think only committee chairs have yellow copies. So there's a revised version. I have a revised version.
Did resolution E.
Okay. I have revised. Is that your...
Where?
It's in the red folder.
Does it say revised at the top?
Yes.
Okay. Does everybody have that? Is there... Read the title, please.
The title is Creation of Confidential Investigator Position, District Attorney's Office.
Thank you. Is there a second? Seconded by Frank. Peter, do you want to report this?
If I could speak just briefly to this... Before speaking briefly to it, I'm going to briefly speak to the first whereas to express my rage at what I heard about happens in Albany, but there was a word in the yellow version that didn't really make a lot of sense, and there was a lot of discussion about it, and it was rewritten so that it did make sense. And that's apparently different than the way it's done in Albany. But in any case, the district attorney came to us and asked us to ask the Public Safety Committee to approve her desire to have an investigator, to add an investigator position to her office. We talked about it. I was a little bit concerned because Mr. McCoy on Law and Order doesn't have an investigator, but then the district attorney pointed out to me that I had missed some sessions that show that the district attorney on Law and Order does have such an employee, so I withdrew my exception. But she made a case for it, and that there are, well, she could make it better than I, but the case simply was that there were certain functions that the office had used a investigator in the sheriff's office to do that particular work, that person tends not to be well enough trained in these particular types of issues, and that she felt that it would be better to be done by an investigator that reported directly to her, and what's more, that the vast majority of the counties in this area had such a position. And that basically was the argument, and then to make it even easier, that she had funding for the first year, and it would not require additional funding. Some people asked the question, well, what about the second year? And since this is a bad time, does it make sense to add another position when, in fact, we may be facing layoff positions? And I felt quite strongly that this is the sort of thing that we ought to bow to the discretion of the department chair, unless we understood that there was fundamentally something wrong with that. Because in a time of contraction, you may very well have to change what you're doing. And the district attorney's office, like everybody else, will be presumably asked to make changes to their budget in some percentage way, like we did last year. And the district attorney may have to decide at that point whether or not this position survives, and does another one get taken off to meet that. And so she thinks it will make the department work better, and therefore we supported it. So that's the argument for it.
Thank you, Peter. Before Jim and Frank, there's a packet on the left side in your red folders. There's a lot of information there if you haven't had a chance to look at. Jim and then Frank.
Yes. This afternoon, prior to this meeting, we had the district attorney in the room to pass our portion of this resolution with the dollar amounts and all that. And she came to the committee and answered the questions that the Public Safety Committee had put forward at the time. And, you know, she is here. If if anyone can remember the questions they asked, then she can answer them, and in fact she has the questions and answers, and I would suggest that to the district attorney that she might approach the microphone in the back of the room and answer some of those questions that she heard.
Do I interpret that correctly to say you'd like the district attorney to make a presentation?
No.
You just want to be ready. I get it. Right?
Yeah.
All right.
If people have questions for us.
Hi, Gwen. Frank.
Gwen, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Frank.
You bet. Gwen, was there any discussion at all regarding doing this under a contract as opposed to hiring a new employee?
Yes. There were a couple of models that were considered. One was contracting for services. It actually came up in conversation with Mr. Robeson early in the process, as did the model whereby my office might hire multiple part-time people, say retired police officers who would presumably not require fringes. I turn to people who have a little more expertise than I do in the administrative aspects, personnel aspects of these positions, and what I learned was that with respect to contracting for this position, that we might well run afoul of the IRS employer regulations. This came up in a conversation that I had with the county administrator last week. He addressed the issue in the Finance Committee this afternoon. I'll ask him now if he'd be willing to repeat those remarks here, because as a threshold matter, it pretty much sets aside the possibility of going for contracted services.
Yeah, Frank, and I think you've heard this from at least David Squires in the past, if not from both David and myself. There are real restrictions on contract employees. And essentially, if that contract employee looks like a duck, whatever those things are, it's a duck. To be a contract employee, you have to be literally an independent contract employee. You have to be given a task and then not directed at all in terms of when you have to report to work.
Right.
You can't be given equipment at work to do that job. You can't be given office space. You have to be a lone ranger to be able to qualify, and that's probably an exaggeration, but you have to be verifiably independent to qualify as an independent contractor. Otherwise, in the eyes of the IRS, you are a county employee and have to be treated that way. So that really puts a lot of prohibitions in the way of contract employment generally.
That's fine. That simply, just curious. And that answers the question. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, we tried to examine the other models, and this proposal that I put before you, I believe, is the most economical and the most efficient and the most effective way to address the need that we have. If I may, Madam Chair, just make one point of clarification to Mr. Stein's introduction. Could I have about 30 seconds?
Sure.
All right. Mr. Stein accurately recited the thinking on my part that led us to tonight's proposal, with the exception of one thing. It is not my position that the sheriff's investigators are not sufficiently well trained. It has been my privilege to work with the Sheriff's Department from 2007 till 2010 in a reciprocal investigative sort of way. For those of you who were on the legislature years ago, you may recall that in 2007, I had intended during my first term to put forth a resolution or proposal to get an investigator from my office. I was approached by the then sheriff, who asked that I withdraw my request because he needed an investigator too, and there wasn't going to be money for two. In return, he offered to provide me with investigative resources for post-arrest investigation, organization, assistance that would not normally be forthcoming when cases are closed by arrest. It got to be 2010, early 2010, and it became clear that the press of work and the stress of work had outstripped the sheriff's ability to continue to provide those services. In the summer of 2010, I started to prepare a resolution to put forward into the budget process for this year, what would have been budget 2011. As you all know, in late summer of 2010, I was taken ill, and I have been, I was unable to carry forward with anything but the barest bones of my work for a period that lasted until December. Otherwise, this matter would have been before you in the budget cycle previously. But I did just want to clarify, it was not an issue about a lack of training in the sheriff's office. They're very well-trained investigators.
Thank you, Gwen. I have Leslin.
Could I just make one response that I apologize for the misconception that I made.
Thank you, Peter. Leslin, Dooley, Pat.
Thank you, Gwen. That was part of the correction I was about to make. My question has to do with, is it absolutely necessary to have this position now? And if so, why? And does it have to be, it's more than one question. And does it have to be full-time? Because I understood this had been, the relationship had been going well with the investigating the Sheriff's Department based on what you said, things that were working out well. What has changed that requires you to have this position now?
All right. I want to make it clear, I do not come to you lightly outside of the budget cycle. I understand the ramifications of that. I understand the concerns that you as legislators have about that. Why I'm here now is because I should have been here last year, but I wasn't able to be here last year. The numbers of cases have increased. In the last year of my predecessor's administration, we had 121 felony indictments for Superior Court informations. In 2009, which is the last year I have complete numbers for, we had 182. That's just felonies that were indicted or disposed of by SCI. That's not the whole iceberg. It's more than the tip, but it's not the whole iceberg. Also, qualitatively, the nature, the kinds of things we're being asked to investigate is changing qualitatively. Crimes against revenue, for example, fraud of all types. This is a reflection of the austere economic landscape we find ourselves in now. Also, it has long been my position and remains so to this day that investigations into allegations of official misconduct, government corruption, malfeasance in public office is something that is appropriately initiated and investigated by an investigator who answers only to the district attorney. We are called upon at times to investigate alleged allegations of misconduct by police officers. We are involved to investigate allegations of misconduct by officials in towns and villages. These cases in the last 2 years of this second term, we've had more than a handful. These cases are, for whatever reason, on the increase. I believe that they are appropriately investigated by someone who answers to me. So another answer for your question.
Thank you. I think it's just important because the public is asking, you know, why are we creating a position now? And I think it's important for them to hear what you just said. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I heard it in committee, but everybody else didn't hear it.
Could you just, the numbers you said last year of George Dent's term, how many felonies?
The felonies that
were... What was the number you gave? Was
121.
Was felonies?
Indictments or Superior Court informations, which means felonies that were disposed of either by trial or plea. That doesn't count the ones that were investigated and a case couldn't be made. It doesn't reflect our time put into it. There's way more cases than that.
So it's 121 and in 2009, 182?
Correct.
Thank you. Dooley, Pat, Pam.
Well, I'm just intrigued by one phrase in the resolution that refers to the state illegal knife profits settlement. Is that unique to Tompkins County?
No. actually, it originated in Manhattan County. Cy Vance's office undertook an investigation into vendors who were retailing illegal knives all over the state. They made a case against them, and they were able to dispose of the case with a settlement whereby, among other things, the vendors agreed to turn over something like 4 years' worth of their profits to the Manhattan DA's office. The DA then reached out to the district attorneys in the state and said, you can have a share of this money if you will use it to investigate weapons crime, you know, particularly illegal knife crime. So I wrote a letter back and said, absolutely. And if they could, you know, find a way to deal with illegal box cutters, that would be even better. But that's where that came from, was out of Manhattan.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Pat?
That's good.
Gwen, we all know that this past budget season was very tough, and there were cuts made that has put tremendous stress on probably all of our departments, and I think a case could be made that there are people, that there are other places in the county structure where we really need to hire people, because there are unmet needs or needs that are very difficult to meet in our departments, and people are working hard. They're working, you know, they're doing more with less throughout the county, and I'm very convinced by the presentation that's been done here of the need for this person in this department. But what I'm trying to do is balance the need in this particular department versus some of the other departments where we've had to make serious cuts over this past year, and where we probably, if things continue to be as bad as they look right now, are going to have to make some serious cuts going forward also. And one of the things that I'm trying to get a handle on that you might be able to help with is we all know that there are some positions that generate revenue as well as costs. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about the relationship between this position or having a person in this position. We know what the cost would be. That's in the resolution. But is there a compensating kind of revenue for the county by having this person on your staff?
Yes, Pat, I believe there is. One of the things that this investigator, if the position is approved, will work on is partnering with the departments in the county that are trying to recover revenue. And I'm speaking now specifically of the Stop DWI department. I think most of you know that currently there's approximately $300,000 in outstanding DWI fines, unpaid fine money in the county. That has been the subject of much discussion, and it is certainly money that should be recovered and can be recovered. The efforts to get that money are law enforcement-generated efforts. This position would be, one of the responsibilities of this position would be to work on various collection efforts, including a warrant, what we call a warrant night, where we send people letters who owe money. If payment is not forthcoming, we put a warrant out because they're in violation of their sentence on the DWI. This is something that will be a large part of the job. Secondly, this investigator will be tasked with working on crimes against revenue, all types of fraud, including fraud in the county, welfare fraud, Medicaid fraud, any kind of crimes against revenue. So there could be some prevention of loss as well as the actual collection of dollars that are out there in large numbers that are owed to the county in the criminal justice system. So it would be a perfectly appropriate sphere of operation for an investigator in my office.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gwen. I got Pam, Frank, Mike, Carol, Jim.
My question was already answered.
Okay. Frank.
Gwen, I want to make sure I think I heard you say, and
this position would be able to back up the fraud unit in DSS?
Actually, my office is the recipient of a grant called Crimes Against Revenue Prosecutions, CARP. We will be investigating and prosecuting all types of fraud, and yes, certainly, we have investigated fraud cases brought to us by DSS over the years. We certainly would continue to do so in future. And I believe the presence of an investigator in my office would facilitate that greatly.
Thank you.
Now, I think I said Mike Carroll, Jim. That sound familiar? Go ahead, Mike.
I don't question the need here. I think there's legitimate need. But I'm really having a problem supporting this resolution for a number of reasons. One is that it's not coming to us at budget time. Two, as Pat said, we've already turned down a number of positions. I think of the one in the mental health department, for example, that we turned down budget season last year, which was a pretty important request from that department. This is committing us to go to the state and ask for home rule legislation for this particular position to give that person 20-year retirement. I think that's an important thing that folks have to understand about this. Remember that our deputies are some of our most expensive employees, and this makes this the equivalent of a deputy sheriff not in the sheriff's department, but in the district attorney's office. I think that's something that we need to think about, especially with a review of the problems in the pension systems statewide. Are there other people that could fill this position? I would guess so. Joe, your point about hiring somebody on contract is probably valid. However, that doesn't necessarily happen if a firm is hired. For example, if the county contracts with a firm that provides investigative services, that would not be the same kind of thing as just hiring one particular individual. I realize that there's money here that certainly one-time money that would help. I can't believe that this wouldn't come back to us in year two to ask us to please continue it, especially if we've brought somebody on and giving them the good retirement. I don't know whether we really want to hire a deputy sheriff to try to collect our DWI fines. Is that something we really want to do? Or I understood this person was to be in there looking at white collar crimes, particularly. And Gwen, I might be wrong on that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that would be a much more important thing for that person to do. A lot of the DWI fines, I would guess, are not being paid because they don't have the money to pay them. And I don't think most judges are going to throw people in jail if they can't pay. They'll throw them in jail if they won't pay. So these are the problems I'm having in supporting the resolution. I'm sorry, because I think there is a need.
Glenda, you want to address that?
Yes. Where to begin? I don't know about the problems with the state with the pension system statewide. I can't address that. What I can say is that district attorney investigators in counties that are demographically roughly similar to ours are, to the best of my knowledge, all subject to the 20-year retirement. They are not deputy sheriffs. When you say we don't want a deputy sheriff collecting our DWI fines, the person, the successful applicant in this position would not be a deputy sheriff. They would be the district attorney's confidential investigator. And they would indeed be charged and tasked with investigating white-collar crime. And they would indeed be tasked with partnering with the sister agency in the county, Stop DWI, in order to help collect the monies outstanding there. Now, you certainly go back in the legislature far enough to remember the efforts that Mr. Dente's made on one occasion during his term where there was a warrant night and where significant money was collected as a result of that effort. I do not think that it's a futile process, nor do I think that the results of doing it would be insignificant. They weren't historically. I'd also like to note that in terms of my department's work with the legislature in the tough economic times that we've been in through the last two budget cycles has shown that I have been more than willing to cut. I've cut past bleeding, I've cut past the bone, I've cut off limbs. As you know, I eliminated a position in my office last year. I made the requisite cuts and I put not one dime back in as an OTR. I do understand the position the county finds itself in. I wouldn't be standing here tonight asking for this if I didn't think it was necessary, if I didn't think there were compelling reasons. I mean, to put it, in a bottom line way, as the elected DA, I'm not only the chief law enforcement officer of the county, I'm the steward and the advocate of resources and the public safety interests. I stand before you tonight respectfully because I submit this is the best, the most economical, and the most efficient way to address the need, and that the timing is compelled by that need.
I'm going to put myself in after Jim. So Carol, Jim, and Peter. Me and then Peter.
Carol.
I'm sorry, Carol. Carol was next. Okay. Thanks, Gwen. I have absolutely no issue with any of our department heads, and not least one who's been independently elected, coming to us and saying, I have this additional money. I've brought in some grant money, and I have this money that is now in our budget, and I'd like to spend it on X, whatever it is, and take your recommendation, and I think this will be well spent on this now. And I would have no issue coming to us with the 2012 budget process and saying, here's my overall budget, I'm within target, and I'd like to spend it thusly and keep this position and adjust the rest of my budget in other ways. The point at which I will have questions and that I'm still trying to understand is the relationship between this and our 2012 budget process. I asked at the budget meeting this afternoon, and I'm still not sure I entirely understand what happens when this comes to us. When you come to us for 2012 budget, and we don't know yet whether this will be in there, how will this come to us? And do you have a commitment to sticking within a 2012 budget, whatever the target that we set, subject to the usual over-target process?
What we heard, yes, I think I understand what you're asking. What we heard in the Budget and Finance Committee this afternoon from Joe, who's here and can correct me if I misstate it, is that the position that I'm proposing here tonight is a position I'm proposing to pay for in 2011. So there's no local dollars going into the position, so my target is not being increased by the passage of this resolution, but if it does pass.
That's right.
Okay. So part A of your question was, so will it inflate my target for the 2012 budget? I believe the answer to that is no. And then your second question, I believe, is, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I heard was, can I guarantee that I could pay for it in total in the future? And the answer to that is no, of course I can't guarantee it. Do I think I can pay for a significant amount of it? Will I try to pay for all of it? Absolutely. My department will continue to be eligible for significant grant funding, such as the CARP grant, such as Homeland Security, and I do anticipate, if things continue with crime the way they have, that we will realize some assets from seizure and forfeiture. It will be my aim, absolutely, to be able to pay for this position. I can't guarantee that I'll be able to, and I do hear what is being said tonight about making no promises or concessions that
the local dollars will exist for this position in budget 2012. So did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Especially about the target. Jim, and me.
Martha, I simply want to say that the numbers the DA have presented, not only this afternoon but last week at Public Safety, are compelling enough on the surface to support the idea of the department having an investigator. It makes sense to me that what happens in government right now, we are constantly going through changes and evolutionary things that happen at the local government level. Years ago, it was 121. Now it's 182. We have created positions in other departments. Some were partially funded based on incidents and ideas and issues that we had to deal with. My sense is I read what's left of the paper and listen to the radio, and I understand that there are crimes, and I think everyone does in the community, that all these things are on the rise. They're not just leveling off. And I think for this department, no matter who heads it up, they need to have a good investigator of their own that they can count on to work on these kinds of issues that we have.
Thank you, Jim. Briefly, I would note that the issue about the retirement plan is in this one to the fifth, whereas the purpose is to encourage, in order to encourage applications from experienced law enforcement personnel. That's really a part of the attraction here, that as Gwen's really looked over the qualifications, the kind of person she'd be looking for, that would be a key point. It was discussed in, I think, one of the committees, but this would be an at-will position. So anybody applying for this kind of knows that, you know, it's not as locked in as a civil service position. So that's obviously under Gwen's purview as she prepares the 2012 budget. And if, you know, based on however many months you have in seeing how this works out, the next 6 months or whatever, you know, it's Gwen's decision to figure out if this is worth more than something else she might have to cut. Let's say if the money isn't there as it is this year. So all things considered, I know this is a really tough decision. I appreciate the debate on this. I will support it. I just wanted to take a minute and say that. I have Peter, then Brian, then Kathy.
I'll call the question.
Is there a second for that? All right. Is there a second? All right, that fails for lack of a second. Brian, Kathy, then Dooley.
Thanks, Martha. This kind of goes against my grain, and it pains me to tell you that I am going to oppose this. I'm going to keep my personal views away and thoughts and so forth as to this position in it. Its entirety and timing and so forth, we're talking about a position that this is the world that I'm aware of, that I came from. I certainly understand all three presentations that I had with you, Gwen, I did not disagree. You will never find me disagreeing with having more chance to investigate more things, because it can always happen. Had I been around back in 2007, again, I probably would have disagreed with that, with the arrangement that was made, only because reality has happened now where that position is not a liaison to the DA's office and has been incorporated into the sheriff's office. And I could have guessed that probably would have happened. As some of you know, I was consulted fairly early in this process, and I do appreciate that. And I did offer some alternatives, some ways. I mean, let's face it, we're talking about money. We're talking about the job, and we're talking about money. And I did offer some alternatives. Yes, I brought up the concept of contracts. I heard finally today, and I still have not had a chance to read it, things that Joe has mentioned about not being able to do that. I also heard from Mike that you can do that in certain circumstances. I guess I'm living proof that you can because I have personally a couple of contracts myself doing this sort of work for municipalities. So, you know, I'm assuming that that went through attorneys and so forth, and I do have physical contracts, and I guess I'll just leave it at that. I also offered, hey, this is a new concept. It's a tight budget year. Let's try it as a halftime person. You know, again, that wasn't preferable, and that certainly wasn't really discussed very much. I guess my other thing would be, have we thought about taking back that position from the sheriff's office back to where it was originally supposed to be as a person that works at the DA's office? These are just some thoughts. I'd certainly be glad to talk about this position during the normal budget process. My main thing, and let's face it, because I was in this sort of work publicly for a long time, people know that I'm on this legislature, and they're aware that this position, the proposal for this position, has come about. So I have been sought out both by just general people in the public and, you know, people within government. Most of the responses I got were that at this time, this request was irresponsible, given the current climate, the fiscal climate that we're in. It's certainly possible, I hate to say likely, that this position might not be around next year. Certainly we do know, or at least we can gather, that there's a lot of other positions within county government that probably aren't going to be there as a result of the whole budget mess that we have. I think that this is dangerous not only for the DA's office, but for the person who would accept this position. You want someone that's experienced in law enforcement. You want to give them a 20-year retirement. You want to have them as an at-will employee. That pretty much narrows the field. You've pretty much got to have a present, someone that's a qualified civil service right now investigator willing to take this position. There's only two ways. There's either someone that's an investigator now or has been, or someone that's retired. Those are the only two. And to expect someone to vacate their civil service protected position now and turn into an at-will employee, not knowing if the funding is going to be there for next year, that's a dangerous proposition for that person. And it's also dangerous for the DA's office to get used to having someone around and having these duties being done, only to find that there's not going to be funding for it.
Thank you, Brian. I'd like to have ask that people kind of not repeat arguments that have been up. We've been on this a long time, but I've got Kathy Dooley, then Jim. So try to be crisp if we can.
I'm going to support this, and I'll tell you why. At the budget meeting, I grilled our district attorney on concerns that I had, and I don't think that any of us goes into creating a new position rashly. But what sold me on it was a combination of things. I put the note out, you know, the press releases that Marcia gives us out on our Fall Creek listserv, and often I get responses, sometimes within a couple hours of posting it. I love our community. And two people that responded to me right away said, has crime increased in our community? And at first I was like, you know, I'm not on public safety, but, you know, maybe it's just possible that we're catching more of the crooks. I'll find out. Well, this PDF report that we got today, I love pie charts, but also the bar graph indicates that we have an increase in crime in our community. And it's not just that we're catching more people. The phrase that I like, if I heard it right, was this austere economic outlook that we have. A lot of us know firsthand what that austere economic outlook looks like, and there are some folks that it drives to crime. So the one thing that rises to the top of the list countywide when it comes to quality of life issues that you can pretty much count on, at least among my constituents that are urban, and I'm betting, because I've heard this often from my rural constituents, is crime, or trying to figure out how to be safe from crime. So the other thing that I heard, the second part, part two for me, was revenue. If there's a way that this could be, if not revenue neutral for us, maybe even help us to tighten up some of the revenue stream losses that we have due to outstanding fines, not just the outstanding DWI fines, but we talked at committee about uncollected penal law fines. And I heard a reference to a warrant night, and there's ways that this could help us to curb some of the problems that we're having in our community, problems that, like Nathan would talk about the broken window theory, that if we don't deal with, we'll regret. If we don't deal with it, it's at our peril, both literally and figuratively. I don't usually go for things like this, but I think she also answered the other big objection I had, and that's why now. As somebody who has been graciously understood by my colleagues to have had health problems, and I appreciate y'all's response, I would expect nothing less than a gracious understanding of the situation and our district attorney's situation. And I think all of those were my key reasons, and I think it's asked and answered, and I think at some point we have to take this elected official at their word and let them go with this. Don't think for a minute that I'm not going to be watching this just as close as y'all are, because I've probably voted no to more public safety requests than everybody in this room put together. And I don't say that as a boast. I say it as something that is on my mind a lot, especially these days as I'm getting a little older. So our demographic shift is something else we need to attend to. I'm going to support this, and I hope my colleagues will consider supporting this as well.
Thank you, Kathy. Dooley?
Well, mine is a question. I hadn't focused on the home rule request to the state for 20-year retirement. Is soliciting someone to fill this position going to wait upon the state acting on home rule request?
Joe or Gwen?
I'm going to have to defer to Joe on this one.
Well, I think you can recruit, but you have to fairly represent that the 20-year pension is contingent upon the state legislature giving us the home rule authority to put this position into a 20-year pension plan. So as long as you're fair in your representations to your candidates, then it's okay to proceed to recruit.
And a written job description would have to have that same waffle in it then, is that right?
if not the job description, then at least, again, the way it's advertised to prospective candidates, it's a step that has to be taken still.
I support this, but I'm worried about what those two pieces mean together.
Do I understand this is a hunting license? All right, thank you. Jim?
I would call the question now if someone would second.
Is there a second?
Thank you.
Okay, question has been called. All in favor of calling the question, please raise your hand. Any opposed? 13-1. Pam, I'm sorry, which was your vote? What? Pam was a no?
Yeah.
12-2. Then it is time to vote on revised resolution E. Please raise your hand if you're in favor of the resolution. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Opposed? That passes 11-3. Thank you very much, Gwen.
Thank you.
I would like to ask for a 5-minute break, and then when we come back, I would like to, out of consideration of dear Paula Younger, go to Resolution F on the minutes, and then we will be back to our order of things. So please come back at 8:06. And women, the restroom here is not working. There's one down the hall on the left. Thank you.